The year 2023 has thus far been a turbulent one for the U.S.-China relationship. An already deeply strained relationship has been rocked further by a number of significant events, including the spy balloon episode and the meeting between the U.S. Speaker of the House and Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently concluded a visit to Beijing with the stated purpose of reestablishing and reinvigorating high-level contact between the two governments and, in essence, stemming the hemorrhaging in the bilateral relationship. And in the wake of the visit, new controversies have arisen. What are the prospects for the U.S.-China relationship for the remainder of 2023 and beyond? Is a materially or even incrementally improved relationship between the two countries possible in the foreseeable future? My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to discuss these and other important questions is Dr. Susan Shirk, a research professor and founding chair of the 21st Century China Center at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. Susan, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
From 1997 to 2000, Dr. Shirk served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs with responsibility for China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Mongolia. She is the author of China, Fragile Superpower, The Political Logic of Economic Reform in China, and most recently, Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise. Susan, I want to talk with you about your most recent book, but before we do that, let me ask you a few questions about the current state of the U.S.-China relationship. First, what is your take on the recent visit to Beijing of U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken? Do you think the visit resets the relationship in any major way or otherwise opens the door to palpable improvement in the relationship in the immediate future?
Well, thank you very much, David. And I was very glad to see Secretary of State Blinken finally pay this important visit to China. And I'd say that it was modestly successful, but that I don't see that it resets the relationship in any fundamental way. But it does open the door to the two sides, both of which have good reason for trying to restore a normal diplomatic communication between one another. It opens the door for them to have other high-level meetings in the lead-up to the APEC meeting that will occur in California in November, at which we expect Chinese President Xi Jinping to attend and to have a face-to-face meeting with President Biden.
Susan, most of the issues on the U.S.-China bilateral agenda appear to be stuck. Would it be fair to say at this point that there are some issues on the bilateral agenda, issues important to either the United States or China or both countries, that the two countries are simply never going to agree on? And if so, what do you think that means for the U.S.-China relationship, and what should it mean?
Well, of course, there are some significant issues that the two countries are never going to agree on. And those are areas where we probably should invest less effort, diplomatic effort, effort even on sanctions, because our ability to change Chinese actions isn't very significant. So in that column, I would put the thought reform of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. I would put Beijing's takeover of Hong Kong and the suppression of freedoms in Hong Kong. And Taiwan possibly falls in that category, but it means that although we don't agree upon the status of Taiwan, we actually have managed to maintain peace in the Taiwan Strait for many decades. So, you know, there are issues that we may not agree on, but there may be other areas. And I, in that column, I would put economic and trade issues. I would put people-to-people ties, academic ties, visa issues, journalists, transportation, air flights, where we should be able to negotiate resolution of our differences. And then there are other issues related to regional security, South China Sea, East China Sea, where we can preserve a peaceful environment even without agreeing on, for example, the international law status of the South China Sea.
Susan, the substance and tonality of U.S. public and political discourse on China has changed radically over the last 6 to 8 years. To what degree has this shift been driven by considerations of national interest? And to what degree has the shift been driven by the current U.S. politics of China? And do you think that those two sets of considerations take policymakers to the same place or to different places in terms of policy choices?
Well, of course, what you hear from the Chinese side is that it's all America's fault and it's all about American domestic politics. And what people in the United States say is that China changed and that China is now a much more significant threat, not just because of its increased capabilities, military capabilities, economic capabilities, but also because its actions deviate from this whole notion of peaceful rise, which it had embraced for several decades after Mao's death and during the period of economic reform. So it's certainly true that China changed. And in my book, you know, I think people would probably take away that on balance, I attribute the change in the development of this much more adversarial relationship between U.S. and China as due to the fact that China's domestic and foreign policy really did change. And actually, this started even before Xi Jinping came into power in 2012. But on the other hand, I also recognize that in the United States, and I'm quite critical of this, certainly in my last chapter, I think the United States has overreacted to China's overreaching. And so American policy also plays a role in this downward spiral that we are experiencing right now.
Susan, I really appreciate those points, and I want to come back very shortly to your notions of overreach and overreaction. But just on the topic that you just mentioned of the notion that China has changed, I know, as you point out, that that really is the way that the United States and official Washington sees China, that China is now on a fundamentally different trajectory than it had been in recent decades. Is it fair or perhaps inaccurate to see China's behavior today as still on the continuum or along the same trajectory that we saw earlier, but just that China is now a more powerful country? Or has there been a qualitative change in the way China sees the world that's more than just a function of the fact that China is now more powerful? Because as we know, when countries become more powerful, they tend to construe their interests more expansively. So maybe if you could share a little bit about your take on the changes that have occurred in China in terms of its behavior and its objectives.
You know, for most of my career, and I have been studying China for more than 50 years, and first visited China in 1971, and before then, was doing research on China from Hong Kong. So for most of this period, China has been a very positive story, and it's been very gratifying to be involved in it. People's lives in China were improving. China's relations with other countries, including the United States, were getting better despite the vast differences in their political systems and the fact that China's power was growing. And it took a lot of diplomatic skill from both sides to achieve this positive trajectory. And China's leaders pursued a strategy of restraint and reassurance to make sure that other countries didn't view them as a threat and that its intentions were benign. This is what we mean when we talk about a peaceful rise. So it's not just about China's growing power. Graham Allison and I debate this all the time because he sees power transition and the growth of China's power or any rising power's capabilities as being the driver of a risk of war between the incumbent power and the rising power. Well, I mean, there's certainly something to that. But what we see on the China side for sure is that China's behavior drastically changed in the mid-2000s. And this is even before the global financial crisis, when many people in China concluded that the United States was on the decline, and so China didn't have to act like Mr. Nice Guy anymore. But some of it started as early as 2006 in terms of provocative behavior against other Southeast Asian claimants in the South China Sea, the rise of a stronger governmental role in managing the economy after decades of decentralization and marketization, and also a tightening up of control over society and media. So these things occurred around 2006, 7, 8, even before the global financial crisis. Then the financial crisis reinforced that trend. And then by the time that Xi Jinping comes to power in 2012, we have a much more extreme case of Chinese overreach.
I want to turn to your book in a moment, but let me ask you one other question that I think relates to all of this. And that is, do you think the United States today is seeing and understanding China clearly and calibrating its response to China appropriately? Do you see any flawed assessments or strategic assumptions on the part of the United States that undergird our current U.S. approach to China? Or are we getting it basically right?
I think there are two ways in which we could see China more clearly. One is that instead of vilifying Xi Jinping as an individual autocrat, dictator, we could understand how this dictatorial regime really operates. The other way in which I think we don't see China clearly is that we've basically given up on trying to get Chinese decision makers to moderate their policy. There's this gloom of fatalism over the relationship in which Americans have just concluded that China's our enemy and that's that. And so the best we can do is just weaken it to make it less of a threat to us. I believe that we haven't really given a fair shot. We haven't really tried to use a combination of diplomacy and pressure to get China's current leadership to moderate its policies. We haven't had any really serious diplomacy for pretty much 7 years, starting from the beginnings of the Trump administration. And now the Biden administration, I'm really happy to see them accelerating or beginning an effort at diplomacy. But it's pretty late in the Biden administration. They did a lot of other things first in order to build up their leverage. This is their thinking, build up their leverage and their ties with allies and partners so we could shape the environment around China. But we didn't really start talking seriously to China until very recently. So I'm actually agnostic. I'm not sure that under Xi Jinping, the Chinese leadership will change its actions in response to our efforts. But I think we at least should test that proposition.
I want to turn to your most recent book, Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise, and come back to something that you mentioned earlier, this notion of overreach. When you use the term overreach and the word over in that context, against what expectation or standard are you measuring? So over relative to what? And can you give us some examples of that overreach?
The way I define overreach is not just being pushy or aggressive or repressive domestically. It's taking things too far, overdoing things in a way that then snaps back to harm yourself. So really, the key part of the argument is that China itself is being harmed. And you know, I wrote the book for a Chinese audience even as much as for a Western or foreign audience, because I think from the standpoint of Chinese national interests, it's really damaging itself through a lot of its actions. And I wanted Chinese people to think about that. Now, of course, the book is not going to be translated into Chinese and published in China. So I'm not sure how many Chinese will ever get to read it, but that was very much in my mind, that I didn't see it as a book kind of slash and burn attack on China. Instead, I have a kind of friendly attitude toward the Chinese people and hope that they would gain a better understanding of how China could be better off under a different set of policies.
Let me ask you a question on the other side of the ledger, if you will. When assessing the U.S. policy response to China over the last 6 to 8 years, or even perhaps even further back than that, you've used the term, as you did earlier, overreaction. So my question for you is, in what ways has the United States overreacted to China? And in your view, is there any realistic way at this point to dial back the U.S. response and return to a more appropriate or proportionate or surgical response to the challenges that China poses to the United States?
What concerns me is not that I don't see China as a threat. I think that China potentially is a security threat to the United States, and certainly it has a very different set of political principles that the party adheres to, different political system. But you know what? That's been true for decades. And I think the fact that I'm an old China hand who's been watching China since the Mao era, I've seen how even under a very different, you know, communist political system, Chinese decision makers have pursued a more pragmatic and flexible policy. And I'm really surprised that China's made the kind of U-turn back to this very rigid ideological and autocratic system that it has under Xi Jinping. So, you know, I wouldn't have predicted this a few decades ago. So I believe it's also very difficult to predict the future. I don't necessarily believe that the system we have in China today is all that resilient and stable. I think there are many members of the Chinese political elite, many Chinese politicians who are not happy with the complete absence of power sharing under Xi Jinping. And they don't necessarily agree with Xi Jinping's rash actions, like supporting Russia so effusively and not criticizing Russian actions in Ukraine, like the way Xi Jinping handled the extreme zero COVID system and then suddenly abandoned it, like the crackdown on the private sector, the complete suppression of access to information, even economic information. How are you going to run an economy rationally without giving people access to economic information? So there are so many mistakes that Xi Jinping has made. And this is, of course, what Deng Xiaoping recognized about the Mao era. And the reason why Deng Xiaoping proposed collective leadership, because he said that under Mao, over-concentration of authority leads to arbitrary decision-making. And that's what we see under Xi Jinping. So, you know, there's a lot of human agency here. It's not just about greater power or capabilities. And it wasn't completely predictable. So I don't think the future is predictable either. And I think the United States should kind of prepare for the long game with China, which, by which I mean, we need to extend a certain amount of goodwill to the Chinese people. We need to lay the groundwork for a more effective diplomacy and test whether or not we can get China to moderate its policies through a more mixed strategy than one that is so completely hostile as the one we're pursuing now. And when I say that, I mean mostly I'm referring to the restrictions on technology, inbound investment, soon to be outbound investment, visas for students and researchers, framing the relationship as a contest between freedom and autocracy. I mean, there are so many ways in which the United States has signaled a kind of unremitting hostility toward China, which I feel will backfire on us. It will reduce our own competitiveness, and it won't put us in a very good position to take advantage of any future political changes in China.
One of the themes that weaves through your book is the question of what China wants and what its strategic objectives are. A large and growing number of Washington-based officials in both the executive and legislative branches seem to believe, or say that they believe, that China seeks to supplant the United States as the world's only superpower, as we, the United States, define the term superpower. Do you believe China seeks to replace the United States as the world's only superpower?
Well, I don't believe that China's monolithic. And so every time I hear this question, what does China want? What does that mean? I mean, we can talk about what Xi Jinping wants, and maybe he does want that, although he would deny that. He's certainly a more ambitious leader than Hu Jintao was or Jiang Zemin. So maybe he does want that. But I know that there are many other members of the Chinese elite who do not want that, who do not think that's feasible and thinks that's a formula for war. And that isn't their objective. I do think that most people in China want their country to be well-respected in the world. They want China to be an international leader, but do they really aspire to supplant the United States? I have no idea. I kind of tend to doubt it. And then secondly, I think for the United States to have primacy, America being number one, that's what it's all about. That's our goal, is to remain number one in everything and to make sure that China doesn't get close to our capabilities. I think, to me, that kind of smacks of a playground fight. It's a kind of immature, primitive way of looking at American goals. I think American goals should be to have America be well respected in the world. I'm in favor of American leadership and involvement. I think by and large, we're a force for good, but I don't think America has to be number one in everything. And, you know, I don't think we should be so nervous and insecure about that. And I think it's ends up being harmful to ourselves.
I want to pick up on this notion of the incredible hostility that the United States is signaling toward China in so many of our statements and so many of our actions. And you alluded to that earlier. Is there a way at this point, realistically, given the politics of China in the United States, to get back to a more measured, national interest focused, kind of cooler headed style of diplomacy and overall approach to China? Or do the politics of China and the perceived political imperatives relating to China in the minds of U.S. political leadership really preclude any backtracking toward a more moderate and national interest based stance? Is there any way to get to a better place, in your judgment, in the foreseeable future, in terms of dialing back that hostility that we've signaled?
Sure, there is. I mean, I don't buy this fatalism about American politics or about U.S.-China relations. I think that it doesn't take that much. It really takes some opinion leaders who ask questions about what are the costs and what are the benefits of our current policy. You know, are we, in the name of national security, harming our own competitiveness by building walls around the United States, essentially becoming more like China, more nationalist, more exclusionary? You know, we're losing not just Chinese investment in the United States, we're losing investment from other countries too, because they don't want to get caught in the crossfire of U.S.-China relations. So they'd rather be in some third country where they can escape the flak, they can hide from the flak. I mean, it seems very obvious that if we think about economic self-interest, that we are harming ourselves by taking our worries about national security to an extreme. You know, export controls used to be about non-proliferation, preventing technology from getting into the hands of a potential adversary and building up specific weapons, nuclear weapons, other weapons of mass destruction. But now it's just this concept has expanded way beyond that to so many different kinds of technologies. Everything's dual use. And so the collaborations in business, in universities, between scientists that we've had that have really contributed to human progress are being impeded because of our overreactions. And this has also led to a lot of suspicion and racial bias against Chinese Americans, and that's also affected other Asian Americans. So I feel that our overreaction has really been harmful to us, and I don't see why we can't think more rationally about the costs and benefits of our policies and try to put some limits to bound these restrictions that we're imposing on our interrelationship, our interdependence. And, you know, it really would only take a few influential members of Congress to do this.
Susan, there's so much that I could say in response, but I can sum it up by saying I couldn't possibly agree more with everything you just said. So I really appreciate your making those points. I am pessimistic, however, that we can get to that better place, but I completely agree with you that the need to get to that better place is great and that it can be done, but it takes political courage and it takes a willingness to look at these issues on the merits rather than filtering every decision through the prism of electoral politics. And I have to say, I'm not too sanguine about the likelihood that that can happen, but I think you've summed it up beautifully, and I really agree with those sentiments. Let me ask one final question, Susan, before we conclude. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about the issue of Taiwan. And in short, I think we're all aware that there seems to be more and more discussion in the United States, coming out of Washington in particular, but more generally in our national discourse, about the evident increasing likelihood of war over the issue of Taiwan. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to weigh in on your take on the cross-strait picture and the likelihood or unlikelihood of outright conflagration and outright military conflict occurring between the United States and China over the issue of Taiwan.
Well, you know, one of Xi Jinping's big mistakes was to cut off all dialogue with Tsai Ing-wen, simply because she's from the Democratic Progressive Party. I mean, it's very interesting that Hu Jintao kind of carved out Taiwan cross-strait policy and pursued a flexible approach to Taiwan that included dialogue, opening up, and integrating the economies in order to win the hearts and minds of the people of Taiwan as a way of preventing Taiwan's moves toward legal independence. And that worked pretty well. And if Xi Jinping had continued to talk to Tsai Ing-wen, who really, I have tremendous admiration for her. I think she's a tremendous political leader. She would have been a very good interlocutor for Xi, but tragically, he broke off dialogue with the Taiwan government and instead ramped up military and economic pressure on the island. So now we have an election coming up, and it's most likely that another DPP politician will get elected, and that person will probably be not as pragmatic as Tsai Ing-wen was. So it could definitely become a more tense situation after that election at the end of this year. But the war scare that has gotten quite intense in Washington and actually in China too. I don't share the view that we're facing the imminent risk of war in the Taiwan Strait. I think that Xi Jinping and the Chinese leadership would still be cautious about trying to invade or forcibly blockade Taiwan, because the risk of trying and failing is the downfall of the current Chinese leadership and maybe even Communist Party rule. So regardless of how the Chinese view Taiwan, US, and allies and friends, defense and deterrence of Taiwan, and by the way, that's only getting stronger militarily, I think that it's highly unlikely that she would try to do it. But let's remember that she has made a lot of mistakes. He has a tendency to rashness, to risk-taking. So we can't rely on his prudence, that's for sure. And so we need to be very cautious in terms of U.S. policy. We don't want to provoke them into the very thing that we're trying to prevent by showboating how much we love Taiwan through various symbolic acts that don't really help Taiwan, but just provoke Xi Jinping. So we need to be prudent ourselves about that. And when I see members of Congress introducing legislation to formally recognize Taiwan as a sovereign, independent country, I think that would be a huge mistake. And we would have only ourselves to blame then if there were a military attack on Taiwan. And meanwhile, the folks in Taiwan also have to be prudent. They have to recognize that the current situation isn't really so bad for Taiwan, and they will not want to provoke Beijing either. So, you know, what's kind of ironic is that those of us who work on U.S.-China relations, we actually see that all three parts of this triangular relationship have tacitly managed to preserve peace in the Taiwan Strait for decades. It's actually quite an achievement by all of us. So there really is no reason we can't continue to do that for more decades to come.
You know, Susan, I think that's really well said. And I would just add before concluding here that I think what has been true for these last several decades is that all three players, the mainland and Taiwan and the United States, have all recognized, and these are my words, but kind of channeling, I think, the overall sentiment that the current status quo across the strait is the worst possible status quo that you can imagine, except for every other conceivable alternative to the status quo. And for that reason, it's held. And as you rightly point out, we've had peace across the Taiwan Strait for decades, and it is achievable. We know that because we've achieved it. And I certainly hope that there's a recognition that we, through wisdom and through working together to maintain the peace, which I think is a shared objective of all involved, it can be achieved, and I hope that materializes. Dr. Shirk, thank you so much for taking the time today to share your deep insights on the U.S.-China relationship. I certainly encourage our listeners to read your book, Overreach, How China Derailed Its Peaceful Rise, which contains some really incisive analysis and much food for thought. Again, Susan, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk with you and also to think back to President Bush's legacy in U.S.-China relations, which is certainly one that is extremely positive and remains with us today.
Well, thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. And to our listeners, remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, where you can follow all our conversations. And as always, thank you so much for listening.